Tonight we're going to complete Romans chapter 1, I trust to do, from verse 26 to verse 32, where we have, I think we'd agree, a thorough description of man in the sense at his worst, man unvarnished, unbridled, revealing his heart. We're going to look at every detail of it tonight. And the aspect there of what a debased mind is like, what are the evidences of it, that great list that Paul makes there from verse 29 through to verse 31. But we note it, we consider it. We note particularly how unedifying a list it is. What a sad litany. What features, things that make us recoil. As we see them and read in that ourselves there. And it is meant to be unedifying. It is multiplying there all the terms that could apply to man at his worst. This is it. This is what it's like. Here it is. Nothing flattering here. Nothing that is going to varnish over man's peccadilloes or little foibles or things. But this is the truth. This is the reality. And it is the Gentile world that would have been very familiar to the people in Rome that Paul was writing to. That is their society, they would say. Yes, we know this. We were part of that. And lots of people we know who are still part of it. And we look at their lives and we feel sad for them. And we today look at our society and we say, yes, that's our world. That's where we are. And we once were part of that. By God's grace, we no longer are. But there are many, many people who still are. And their life conforms to this, at least in part. It's not as if every single detail applies there, and its prominence, as it were, to every single person. But we see enough of it to know, and hear about enough of it to know, that yes, this is our society today. Many other societies there in Western Europe, and when we look further across the world, the same sorts of things come there to our attention. Paul was writing here to both Jews and Gentiles. He's going to, in chapter 2, pick up on the Jews, who, having perhaps read this list, might feel a little bit good about themselves and say, that's it, well, that's the Gentile world there. Indeed, we know that all right. And might have been thinking, well, that's good. We're getting through here. We've got the best position of all. Paul is going to bring some harsh reality to bear upon them. And light there that he's going to shine upon them and their practice. But that awaits chapter 2 here. He is very much homing in upon the Gentile world. And that is his focus as we conclude this look here at Romans chapter 1. What we find, and already began to find as we've unfolded, as it were, some of these verses from verse 18 onwards, is the explanation for this wrath of God that is revealed from heaven. What is the ground for that? Why is this happening? What is the justification? What is it that is attracting God's wrath and anger? What is it he's seeing? We find there, don't we, in the opening verses of that particular passage, there is man, willful man, rejecting clear light. And thus it proceeds from there. We see the evidences of what that rejection means. What is man doing to himself? What is man like who rejects God? And so we see it. And this is why Paul's portrait here spares nobody's blushes, but just says, this is how it is. Lists of things. On and on it goes. What is this? Well, it's man being man. This is man being man. This is man without God. Man let loose. Man able to express himself freely. Here is, if you will, free will. This is what he's about. This is what he's really about. And we see the development of what that ungodliness and unrighteousness there, that God's wrath is revealed against in verse 18, means. These are the developments of those terms. Here is the precise application, like getting the microscope out. Got this object before us, ungodliness, unrighteousness. You want to know more? Well, we'll get the microscope on it. We'll see the various constituent parts of it. We'll tease them out. We'll hold them up for inspection. And we will see that God's wrath is fully, fully justified. Men are without excuse. There's a clear revelation of who God is, large in our conscience, which goes against the various things that we read here and these characteristics there in the world around. His evidence of his nature there, his eternal power and God's head, and still man rejects him. It's at heart a spiritual problem. The relationship between God and man, between man and his maker and his judge. And the sight is not very appetizing. Denying evidences. And then not glorifying him as God. That insistence there in verse 21. They knew God. Their conscience affirmed it. What they saw around them spoke of design. It didn't speak of sort of random process. Oh, no, one has to do overtime with one's intellect there and do the various somersaults that Richard Dawkins would have us do to get to something different. No, it's design. That's what you see. There it is, but they're not going to glorify him as God. And instead, they do this effort there, excluding God and importing something quite unnatural, changing the glory of the incorruptible God into what? The image of man. Image made like corruptible man, and birds, and four-footed animals, and creeping things. And Paul, as it were, this is it, what they do. It's utterly unreasonable. It's ridiculous. It's folly. And yet they do it. And they change him there in verse 23 into that particular way. That's what they do. And they don't glorify him. They glorify anything. They worship anything else but him. And in verse 28, in what we read a moment ago, they don't like actually to retain God in their knowledge. They don't even keep him in their knowledge. Some sort of distant recollection of him. Something that has been handed down to them perhaps from parents, grandparents, Sunday school. No, they will expunge that now and push that out in a very deliberate way. And all of this, painting very dark picture here, and then the sort of rather proud Jew is going to get his comeuppance there in chapter 2. It's all, they're all going to be thrown in together in this. This is where God's wrath is brought upon all of this. This is going to be the backdrop then to the wonderful good news. It's going to break through in Paul's writing in chapter 3 and is then going to be developed and is then going to cause him to so wax lyrical about the glory of Christ. He's showing where we are, where we've got to come up from. This is where the gospel's power is going to be evidenced, as he speaks about in verse 16. This power of God to salvation. This gospel I'm going to explain to you in detail later on. This is where it works. Into this kind of society. In peoples whose hearts are like this. It changes such people with all of their evil-mindedness and murder and strife and pride and violence, boasters, disobedient to parents. It changes people like that. It has transforming power. It can work with such material and revolutionize it. And then they become obedient to parents. They don't become backbiters. They're generous-spirited people towards others. They are not evil people inventing evil. They're actually creative then in seeking how to do good and how to promote the cause of Christ. Energetic in a totally different direction. Paul is not ashamed of the gospel because it does this. Nothing else can. Pagan philosophies there, secular philosophies today, they can't touch these things. They can't radically and fundamentally affect the heart of man. But the gospel can. It can deal with this precise state of man. And it is evidence, too, of how extraordinary is the forgiveness of God that it can take that and forgive it all. It can take people in the grip of those kinds of characteristics, that kind of behavior, that mindset, and forgive them totally, entirely, and freely. Power of what Christ's sacrifice on the cross brings. So we see, as first heading, that by way of introduction, understanding God's judgments. Understanding God's judgments. Well, we're thinking a bit about that, aren't we, at the moment, with floods and things like that. And in a sense, that is what one might expect to happen, that God, when he sees such a society as that, unthankful people, not glorifying him, people without excuse, that they would have, if you will, something like a lightning strike upon them. There would be then some great event that would completely wreck them, pull them apart. We have to say, it's very interesting, isn't it, these extreme weather events. Floods, and we've got more to come, storms, aren't there, places being wrecked and pulled apart, railways, roads, trees falling everywhere, parts of Britain, they're completely underwater. Travelling to Norwich the other day, and there on the Fens, we're used to seeing a bit of water there, stretched out seemingly as far as the eye could see. March, Ely, that kind of area there, some of you will know where I mean. Flatlands, my, absolutely waterlogged, not seen the like of that. Quite extraordinary. Disturbances there in nature. Well, some have written, haven't they? Some have lost their posts in political parties because they have thought, well, this is evidence of the judgment of God. Well, we may well say that there is something certainly happening that is an indication there that God is not allowing our nation or many of the nations to settle, to feel comfortable, but is bringing their discomfort to them. We might perhaps be on firmer ground were we to see that flood affect, say, the Houses of Parliament, sweeping through the chamber, perhaps, some freak accident there. For such things have been known. York Minster appointing an Archbishop of York, David Jenkins, some years back, who denied the resurrection and much else in Scripture and Orthodox Christian faith. Lightning strike, totally unexpected, in a way in which nowhere else, nothing else it affected, but it hit that particular cathedral, Minster. Extraordinary. And in America, there's been a similar situation where there's been discussion, in which church it was, I read about it, though, not too long ago. And they were discussing gay issues, and they were ending up endorsing homosexual behaviour and practice. Anyway, something similar happened to that place. Well, there we see a very specific judgment of God, and perhaps we're on safer ground to affirm there very clearly that there is the judgment of God. Yes, a society in sin can expect disturbances in nature. In a more general sense, yes, but perhaps we can say those places which particularly are singled out there for some freak incident, some strange event like that, very, very clearly have attracted the wrath of God. But what one certainly can see, we'd understand that from the book of Revelation as well, that we're going to get shakings and upheavals and difficulties and discomfortures, even as also the economy continues and many other things continue, much as ever, and people are buying and selling and will be doing until the Lord returns. We can be very clear that there is a judgment of God when you see a worsening moral situation. This we can clearly and distinctly see in this passage we read a moment ago. One can very clearly discern a judgment of God upon a nation when you see the various states of decline and particular things that are held up for approval and to be there lauded. There is a sign that God is judging, much like Pharaoh. Began by hardening his own heart, but then response to these plagues, having opportunity to learn many, many lessons from those and to repent, hardened himself still, and then God hardens him. God begins to deprive him of opportunity to reason, to think more carefully and clearly, to be able to see and conclude that he really ought to humble himself there in the sight of the God who is God over all the earth. He didn't, to his cost. And our nation, largely speaking, isn't either, to her cost. And we see this judicial hardening in the kind of language that is in this section before us, and indeed in verse 24, when it says God gave them up to. Here in verse 24, but here in verse 26, for this reason, God gave them up to vile passions. And again in verse 28, God gave them over to a debased mind. There is that judicial hardening. If we want to know where is there a society that is under judgment, well, we can see sometimes perhaps in these sort of acts there of God, as they're called, nature let loose and raging. Perhaps there one can conclude, well, he's certainly humbling us and teaching us that he's the God over all the earth, not we ourselves. And I feel sorry for the government having to try to, you know, answer all these queries. Why didn't you do this or why didn't you do that? I don't think there's much they could have done against most of this. Completely out of their hands. But where one does see moral decline, and of a particular kind that we'll address in a moment, then one is on very safe ground to say, ah, that is very clear evidence that God is judging. He's giving us over. He is hardening us. He is actually depriving us of opportunity to learn. He's leaving us just to go in our way. And that is very worrying. Very worrying in our nation, because I fear we see it here. What does he remove? Well, these restraints, this giving over from his side, as it were, he's removing his presence, blessing, his favour. His favour that is upon nations sometimes to give them advantages, to give them opportunities. He's removing those. The fear of God. He's allowing that to go. For when the fear of God has gone, even these people may not be converted, but they have a sense still of enduring respect for God. But that's going. They don't retain even the knowledge of God. No fear of God. And he's permitting it to be so. Maybe we can say as well, he's permitting the weakening and the decline of the evangelical church. He's suffering that to be so. That we dwindle, that we're losing, as it were, some ground there. We gain a few victories here. But we have to say, largely speaking, it's hard work, it's difficult. Evangelistic endeavours are struggling. Not only here, they're everywhere. It's the same. They're struggling. Family life. Family life. Well, there is something that grieves us, doesn't it? Family life, the decline, its breakdown, its dysfunctionality. Talking just the other day to somebody, saying something of the situation where she's trying to help. What a mess it is, though. These are unbelieving people, largely. What a mess that they are making. We can there for that one situation advance, I'm sure, thousands and thousands of others here in broken Britain today. Authority structures, social structures that God is permitting to decline, to be taken over by a progressive agenda. Government herself taken over. Judges bringing judgments that are distinctly unhelpful on many occasions, not all, but on many occasions against us. The world of culture in respect of books and programs and art itself, media, music. Oh, again, reflecting there, things very unhelpful. They're showing forth that debased mind, but then helping to progress it further, reflecting it and then creating more change in an unhelpful direction, facilitating more the loss of restraint. How many films and books have been landmarks in the kind of state of decline? How many pop songs have had that sort of influence upon a generation that they've helped to push things in an unhelpful direction? Culture showing now in a deeper sense, that way in which we're thinking about it in Britain 2013. We can update to Britain 2014 now, can't we? But the way in which that just what we're thinking underneath, the things we're proving of, the kinds of things that we regard as okay and the things we don't regard as okay. And that itself there, showing a disregard for God, that kind of direction. New thinking, new morality, new generation. And it looks very much like a society where God has given us up. And that is a very fearful thing. Understanding God's judgments then, we see in Romans chapter 1 that actually a worsening situation like this is a pretty clear indication that we are a society under judgment. And supplementing it there with the shakings of nature, these extreme kind of weather events, and we can certainly see that that case just gets stronger and stronger. But what in particular? Well, my second heading singles out in verse 26, vile passions. Vile passions. Here is an evidence of judgment. When these things begin to manifest themselves very overtly, we can say, we are in difficulty. And those things there, verses 26 and 27, really have a very familiar ring to them, don't they? That's our society today. You see, these are the things, and we read here, don't we? Homosexuality, sexual practice of that particular kind. When it's unleashed, when it's unbridled, when there's something very overt and very okay about it, something that makes it acceptable, that is not an evidence of a good, progressive, tolerant society. That is evidence, we read here, of a society that's been given up. God has given them up to these things when they are let loose. And it is unflattering of these particular kinds of sexual acts because these are contrary to natural use. And a woman and man, these things are against nature. There is something unnatural about them. People are burning in lust. We know that this can become the experience of some of these people, many of these people, that their interest is not in just one other man, one other woman in that homosexual relationship, but others, many in some cases. And God calls it shameful. The expression of these things is shameful. God calls these things vile passions, violent, something unrestrained about them. And ever in God's word, it's a non-negotiable that these kinds of acts he regards as abominable. Now, of course, we know that not all people are going to marry. For whatever reason that might be, some just don't want to. That's absolutely fine. That's very acceptable. And it may be as well, and we have to accept in this, that some have no great interest in people of the opposite sex. They have interest in no particular people. They have people just designed to be single people. There's their work, and they can be very satisfied in just being that, just getting on with the things, perhaps as Christians, that God has called them to do. But others, yes, they have more of an attraction to members of the same sex. And they may not like that. They may feel guilty about that. It's very often the case. And these are not things, these attractions are not things to be celebrated. They are things to do with the fall, and therefore not matters anything any more than anything else that is a legacy of the fall to be celebrated. And these are not God-given feelings that have to be acted upon, as though the argument's made, isn't it, that, well, I wouldn't feel this way unless God had given me these feelings. He's made me the person I am. He's given me these capacities, so it can't be wrong, and therefore I should be able to express them. And that's okay, isn't it? And everything that the fall has given to us, every legacy of the fall, we could argue really the same thing for each of those. Well, we feel the capacity of doing these things, and it's God-given. Everything we are, we would say, we're God-given in that respect. Oh, no. There is the fall. That isn't God-given. That is given by virtue, really, of our being under the dominion of Satan. And we don't want to act upon those things. There is this propensity there. Some of these dear folk, we would say, many of them there, struggling with these things, feeling very guilty about these things, falling to these things, succumbing to these things. But it's a danger. Once conscience is overridden, then it can unleash passion. Can unleash the development of this into something far more than simply just one man and one man and one woman and one woman. Go completely more and further than that. The club scene, cottaging, paedophilia in some cases, sadly we have to report, violence against minors, bathhouses. Well, we don't elaborate on these things, but they are there as expressions of our passions. And there is a penalty in them. God speaks of that, and we have to record that, don't we, sadly, again. So many premature deaths, so many suicides, so much depression and sadness, AIDS, these symbols here of something that is against nature, something that was not meant to happen like this, something that is under the heading there of fallen nature. So this is evidence of a nature, of a society that is under judgment. Evidence that when these things are manifested and evident and seen and are being loosed and are being freed, perhaps, that this is a judicial judgment. It's not only that these acts bring judgment, but their unleashing is a sign of an already existing judgment. There's already a society being judged that will then move on to these things. And we can see that much of the reason for that lies in the general sexual licentiousness, the uncleanness that in a way predates the society we now are, but looks back to the society developing in the 1950s and that really began to take off in the 60s and the 70s. This liberalisation in every regard. This idea of free expression in a sexual way. And that's heterosexual people, perhaps, were at the forefront of this. But ever in the minds of the thinkers, the ideologues of this kind of movement was that homosexual acts should be able to come with it as well. There's nothing wrong in them being expressed too. While it might have begun really in earnest amongst the heterosexual community, that everything began to break down there, always it was on the agenda that this would also be the expression of homosexual behaviour, sexual behaviour. And thus it became decriminalised, then tolerated, and now celebrated, rendered normal, out and proud, becoming the kinds of slogans, that kind of thing. And so now it is unnatural and abnormal to object to this and to say that it isn't good and we can't celebrate this. We're sad at all of this and fear it's the judgment of God and it's not doing anybody any good, most of all the people who are in these kinds of relationships and promoting them and following them. And it's evidence that culture, the underlying way of thinking, has been conquered. There's been a conquest through the media, through books, television programs, seminal, landmark things, happenings, events like that, people, icons, idols in one way or the other who come out as gay and have carried opinion with them and conquered the culture. So that now it's people like us, isn't it, that are liable there to have our words poured over by the thought police and slap wrists and, you know, excluding ourselves by saying the things I'm saying here from, you know, right-thinking society there, excluded out for daring to think or say out loud this kind of negative appreciation of what these acts are about. And this is the sad thing. Stormed government and its battlements, judiciary taken over, largely speaking, the education system there, efforts there, battles to and fro, family life. We find that this is prevalent. Visible, self-advertising, militant. And therefore, what began as a sort of general push there in uncleanness, in sexual freedom, inverted commas, and which had always within it there the movement to bring along with it expression of homosexual activity as part of this general freedom to experiment and do as we will, that there attracted the judgment of God and the hardening. The giving us over allowed for then this blossoming, this flowering of homosexual sexual activity as being something good, as being something that should be celebrated, as something that should be more than tolerated, that we should be proud of as a nation, that we have now got, for instance, gay marriage, as well we know. And it's notable, isn't it, in verse 26, that where it says, even their women, we're being told something significant there, aren't we? Even their women. Now, we've really reached the point of God handing us over when even their women, it's reached to that. That there was something there, that's a wisdom there, that the women were credited with, something more reserved, something more chaste, if you will. Men and their predatory behaviour there, well, that's always been known. Women more restrained and wiser on these things, more protective, to be protected, and their sort of dignity there to be preserved. But now that's gone. That's always going. When that happens, now that is certainly an indication. When even their women exchange the natural use for what is against nature. The figures aren't there out there in the world. Angelina Jolie, bisexual, Drew Barrymore. You read about these people and their backgrounds, it's chaos, absolute chaos. Relationships, marriages, some lasting but months, chaos. Samantha Fox, who was, you know, supposedly a convert there on the Alpha course and all of these things. Now she's declared herself to be a lesbian some years back. This is all now, and apparently in some kind of inverted commas marriage. And the surveys found the number of women experimenting with these same-sex relationships has grown in the last 10 years. Surprise researchers. Grown. It's grown significantly. And this is indeed interesting in the light of verse 26. When we read that even their women exchange their natural use. This giving over. How do we see it? How do we see that God has taken his hand off, withdrawn his hand? Well, it is that the women are now involved in these things. Women folk. And thus we can indeed reflect here soberly upon the generation that we are in. We read further there, verses 28 to 31. The debased mind, these restraints, like the fear of God, family life breaking down, and other areas there, perhaps of culture, and kinds of things that people are interested in and watch and read and copy. Well, these are the behavioral traits. They run, don't they, all of them against the Ten Commandments. One place or another, the Ten Commandments are here being assaulted, being lived in explicit denial of. God is not in their knowledge. They're doing things which are not fitting, which is the inevitable result when God is not in their knowledge. A spiritual problem always leads to moral problems. It's there. That's why it happens. And we find the explicit rejection, new atheism, its actions there, its militancy against true gospel, Bible religion, true God of the Bible. Their greatest venom is reserved for that, though in fairness to some, they're also dishing it out against Islam. Now, that's a fact, so we can say that at least some of them are being consistent. But largely speaking, their greatest venom, their greatest effort is reserved for the Christian faith. New Ageism, which is again a blatant denial of the truth of the Bible. Make it up as you go along kind of religion, paganism, resorting back to these sorts of ideas, producing bad attitudes, producing an ugly moral scene, producing in many places, sadly, vile people to go with the vile behavior. Not that all share everything to the same extent, no they don't, but we see certain things that are common to our culture. How do we measure it? Well, that's a bit difficult to do, but just the sense of the society that we are in. I'm thankful not all people are all like this, all the time. This sounds like Sodom and Gomorrah here, and that's, so it was. And so that society had gone beyond the pale. It was completely given over. And these kinds of behaviours and thinking were just rampant there. Well, we're not there yet, but we seem really in many ways to be going in that direction, embedded in character, embedded in behavior. Licious, meaning spiteful, harm against people. Oh, one sees it. Strife, people not at peace with their neighbor. People angry and aggressive in that way. Haters of God. Haters of God surely are. Humor, laughter against the Lord. That makes us really feel so sad, so incensed that they should speak so ignorantly, not knowing that they are treasuring up wrath for the day of wrath, proud, when they certainly are that many of them, knowing much better than the Christian faith, knowing the remedies for society's ills, those remedies only adding in many places to society's ills, inventors of evil things, undiscerning, for all the knowledge, for all the universities, for all the colleges, for all the degrees, undiscerning. We're no wiser about ourselves. You get more wisdom and truth looking back at the Greeks and some of their kinds of insights there about what was going on in man. They often had more of an understanding than people today do, in the kind of academia. You hear people there on the radio, great titles, but they're absolutely clueless about human nature, really, though it's meant to be their object of study. They don't understand themselves. They don't understand human nature. Now they are foundering around on this, unloving, well, often very sentimental, but sentimentality is not all that love is composed of. It needs that loyalty and commitment. And we know the divorce rates tell us that that is certainly
missing? The base mind. Well, we won't dwell more. We could look at each of those individual items there, I'm sure, and spend a whole week and more than that looking at them and how our society conforms. A culture that is totally overthrown, because there in verse 32, my fourth heading, culture overthrown, that those maybe practiced in secret, those vile passions there, sort of lived out by people in their own sort of privacy of their homes or whatever it might be, those things working away in their hearts. But there's something more in verse 32 where they approve of those who practice them. They are in favor of them. When legislation moves in favor of them, when it very decidedly and explicitly rules for those behaviors and against any who would speak ill of those behaviors, for instance, of homosexual sexual practice, then we really know this is a judgment of God. That approval is given there, celebrated. Any that speak against it, chided and ruled out of public debate, really has to conform to the norm, the cultural expectation. And this is a culture well and truly overthrown, dominated, caught up in these things. Those behaviours there, we know they're rules and policies that are supposed to outlaw any number of them, yet we know those rules and policies there, public agencies, hospitals, which often show anything but being loving and merciful, and the complete opposite. Well, we trust perhaps the Lord may yet bring such a society back from the brink, that yet he may take pity upon us and show us mercy. But at the moment we have to say, no, it is a society that looks like that. The society that Paul knew, the society that he looked out upon. But a society that can still experience there, maybe not in great numbers, but in some numbers, the power of God to salvation. That is where God works. He works in such people as this, such situations as this, even those who are caught up in this wider judgment. But he will work. He had Lot there and his family, at least some of them there in Sodom, rescuing them, preserving them, bringing them out of that. And that God may, in our society, in other societies that are like ours and moved in this kind of direction, to save some. To that end, we pray and labor. May God help us not to lose heart. This is the reality, it's sobering, it's there, and we're better to know it than not. And Paul certainly felt you're better to know it than not. We're realistic and not fools. We don't live in a fool's paradise, fantasy world. That is the trouble, besetting sin in many churches. Fantasy world, they're amazed at themselves at what they're doing. They're doing nothing, achieving little. They're making no impact upon this. May be able to reform a few for a season, but many of those then drop away, the Alpha course being a classic example of that. Whereas it keeps them sort of still just about within the pale of a Christianity, but where some of these things nevertheless are allowed to go on unchecked. No, that's no way there to do full honour and justice to what God is looking for. Change person, new creature. May God help us to be truly new creatures, to live in this kind of society here, as those new creatures, looking whom we may be able to rescue. May God so help us.